Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, 2017, and I'm opening the Joint Committee of Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. This time I got it right. Today we'll be starting a long series of meetings with our colleagues from the Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames, you want to kick us off here?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, just housekeeping, you will note that in OLIS you see not only that agency presentation that they will be showing you on the slides, but also two reference documents, the LFO budget review and the agency's ways and means reference binder, which has a lot of more detailed information than they will probably get to in their slides. The agency director, Lynn Saxton, is here today to start us off with an overview. There is much more to come after this. They will go into specific division work after this, but there will be between their presentations and public hearings, it will be the next month. So lots of other things to follow. So, and I did want to introduce Janelle Evans, who is new this session as the budget director, but she does have bronchitis, so she may not be able to talk. And on the other end is Tom McDonald, who is the chief financial office analyst for OHA. Yesterday you met Tamara. She's the analyst for DHS.
Ms. Saxton.
Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Rayfield, members of the committee. It's a privilege to be with you today. And I do want to say just before we begin that in my career, I have had the privilege of working with six budget directors or CFOs, and it's been a real privilege for me to work with Janelle Evans in her new position as our budget director. She's been with the agency since inception, but it's just been a real privilege working with the entire team to bring this information to you today.
Thanks. And before you go any further, can I just remind you to introduce yourself for the record?
Yes,
please?
And I'm Lynn
Saxton.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you. I always don't know.
We all do it. We all do it.
It's that mic in front of your face. It's a little daunting. I'm Lynn Saxton. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. Our commitment to you today and throughout this process of this legislative session is to get you all the information you need, all the clarity you need. We have a large and complex budget, and please feel free to ask questions or for information you don't see before you. We welcome those questions, and our entire team is committed to getting you accurate and timely information and also helping you understand a complex budget at a complex time in the evolution of healthcare in our country. I'd like to start to first with an overview of the Oregon Health Authority's mission. We help people and communities throughout Oregon achieve optimum physical, mental, and social well-being through partnerships, prevention, and access to quality, affordable health care. And that's in our three principal service portfolios, which include Medicaid services, the state hospital services, and the public health department services. Our priorities are outlined for you here. I'm not going to read them to you. You'll know. Good morning, gentlemen. You'll note that they are in a circle, but I would call your attention to the numbers in the upper left-hand corner because those reflect the priorities set by the OHA leadership team about 18 months ago. Oregon is a national leader in health reform. We've brought you a couple studies here. Here's the most recent Pew study showing the performance and return on investment of the Oregon Health Plan. Research and results are showing that we're leading the nation in many ways. Last evening, in preparation for a conversation with our congressional delegation last week, I had on the floor of my home office all of the documentation showing the strengths and performance of the Oregon Health Plan, and it was a significant amount of data. We're just going to give you the highlights today. First of all, Oregon is one of five states leading the nation in evidence-based policymaking. This is really critical for those of us who care about the impact of care on the people receiving the care. It's not just that they get the care, but it's that the care is effective and successful. We are providing better health outcomes at a lower cost and are ranked 11th nationally in return on investment. It's important to understand, as my colleague Dr. Robertson from Oregon Health Sciences University frequently refers to, is there is a changing role of healthcare in people's daily life. It is foundational. It is foundational if you are wanting to go back to work. It's foundational or get to work. It is foundational if you are wanting to pursue an education. It is the core from which all of us launch our individual lives. In the past, people spent about 30% of their household income on food, 25% on housing, and 45% on everything else, which resulted in about 5% being spent on a household basis for healthcare. Today, the spend is much closer to 5% on food, 25% on housing, with some exceptions, 30% on healthcare, and 40% on everything else. And that's a major shift. I want to share with you next the Health Authority organizational chart. These are my direct reports. Our organizational charts were completed this year. There are 7 divisions of the Oregon Health Authority, and not reflected here is our tribal liaison. Oh, there it is. Our tribal liaison director also reports directly to me. We have total position count of 4,749. The Oregon State Hospital is 2,369 of those positions. I'm happy to share with you the number of positions in the other divisions. It's important to note that 2 years ago we restructured the agency to allow increased focus and accountability on execution. The areas of the agency that are directly responsible for executing programs and services and billing, et cetera, on a daily basis are the Health Systems Division, which is Medicaid services, the Oregon State Hospital, and the Public Health Division. I'd like to highlight a few accomplishments in the last 2 years of these divisions. First, our Public Health Division, which is on the front lines of direct services to people across our state in a variety of circumstances. First, they had in that time period the Harney County and Umpqua shooting events to respond to. In the Umpqua shooting, we deployed the largest behavioral health team in the history of the state, 30-plus volunteers, I want to underscore volunteers, packed up, moved to Roseburg, and lived there for months to ensure that families and community had sufficient supports. That is a model for deployment of emergency response that the Public Health Division developed and could and would use in other circumstances, whether they were natural disasters, medical health disasters, et cetera. We completed our modernization assessment of assessing counties' capacities for responding to a host of public health emergencies, and we'll build on that foundation to work with counties directly to ensure they have the resources they need and that we're being a supportive partner in ensuring access to critical services and emergencies in Oregon. We have a reduced opioid abuse working with a private-public partnership on this initiative. We have much work yet to do. We responded effectively with our partners at the Center for Disease Control in Washington, D.C. to the Zika and Ebola outbreaks, and finally participated as a partner with the Department of Environmental Quality on the Cleaner Air Oregon initiative. There are a number of other important efforts that go on every single day in the Public Health Division. We're happy to brief you individually or collectively on all of that detail. It is a large and really a historic service across the country, and Oregon has been working very hard to move quickly to modernizing how those services are delivered and to building in additional efficiencies to ensure we can improve our capacity. This is the slide we use to show the scope of the public health modernization work. I'm not going to read you the slide, but it's important to note that it includes everything from communicable disease protection to health promotion and environmental health. Currently, about a third of people in Oregon do not have access to public health protections. We need to modernize our public health system around these four foundational programs. There is a work plan in place to do it, and that work is contained in what is known as our State Health Improvement Plan. I'm just going to pause a moment and say, if you are interested in tracking the Oregon Health Authority, there are two on any level. I encourage you to go to our website. Our website will be revised in March and become much easier for people like me to navigate, and hopefully the citizens of Oregon to navigate. But there are two foundational reports that guide and report out on the health authority's initiatives. One is the State Health Improvement Plan, which focuses on population health for the 4 million people who live in Oregon. The other is the Action Plan for Health, which specifically focuses on the coordinated care model and the Medicaid services. So those plans have been updated in the last 2 years and will be available to you on our website and will be the focal points going forward of agency priorities and implementation. I do want to talk a little bit about tobacco. Tobacco remains the number one preventable cause of death and disease in Oregon and is responsible for over 7,000 deaths a year. I grew up, as I know many of us did, with parents who smoked, and it's really hard for me to understand that tobacco remains such a phenomenal health pressure in our state. We have a number of initiatives underway to address it. We consolidated our tobacco operating divisions in the last biennium, but we have some real work to do here, and I'm sure we'll be having rich discussions on tobacco over the course of this session.
We're going to ask questions.
Yeah, you can ask questions whenever you want, Senator.
And I would agree with you on the tobacco. Are you having the same kind of discussion and conversation on alcohol and drugs?
Yes. And marijuana.
and marijuana. Have you thought or looked at two things? One, and taking into consideration a range of dollars that are in alcohol and drug treatment, where gaps exist in the state, and what are the outcomes across this state with respect to, can we today say what's working and what's not working, where it's working and what is not working and why not? I'm really concerned that we've got a lot of between OHA and DOC and all the agencies that have a piece of the alcohol and drug treatment, and yet we don't know what is the outcome, what is working, how many contracts do we have out there, where those contracts are across the state. And begin to get a handle on this whole issue. So hopefully the OHA can help us with that.
Yes, co-chairs, Senator Winters, we have consolidated the data in two locations, and it is available in the two reports I just referenced, but also we can go very deep in terms of what the public health division's efforts do, what is successful, what isn't successful, and where it is successful for population health in Oregon. That's the whole population. And then separately, and with our great partnership with the coordinated care organizations, we have that information on a more granular level with the Medicaid population. So I think overall we have made progress. Particularly, tobacco jumps out when you look at the trend lines in Oregon as just a huge problem. But we do have all that data, and we'd be happy to sit down and review that with you.
You know, I raise that because this body will have to, you know, we have the task of looking at resources and the task of maybe having to look at where we either enhance or reduce or what have you. And with this particular issue, those dollars are scattered throughout agencies in the state. And then the other question is, because they are contracts, the majority of them are contracts out, and I just learned the other day, not necessarily are all the companies in Oregon, but we've also, some places are contract out of state. So, you know, I just like to get my arms around what is.
Yep. Happy to do that.
Thank you. I would say, I mean, the committee's already had a couple of conversations about this during our first 2 days of orientation, but I'll say pretty clearly to you and to your colleagues at DHS and any of the smaller agencies that come through this committee, the word of the year is evidence, and the second word of the year is data. We are making a series of very difficult decisions and making sure that we're getting every bit of bang for every bit of buck that we put in is going to be critical. So whether we do things now during phase one or we come back for more detailed looks at some of these things in phase two, those are conversations that Co-Chair Rayfield and I will be having with LFO staff and with all of you. And just be aware, these questions are going to keep coming and keep coming because we're all very serious about this. And we're proud of Oregon being one of the top states in the nation for use of evidence-based policy, and we only want to get better.
Co-chairs, thank you. I appreciate that opportunity, and we would welcome the opportunity to talk about tobacco, alcohol, and drugs in greater detail. And I'd like to bring the physicians who lead that work for us to that conversation. We are the data and evidence team in everything we do, and we welcome those conversations. I would say that Director Peters and I are professional colleagues and work together on a regular basis. We just had a very detailed conversation about hepatitis C earlier this week and are working carefully and closely, as well as our work with DEQ, DHS, and other agencies where our work overlaps. One of the issues with modernizing public health is the funding structure that is historical for public health, and we see some opportunity there to advance change even without a different funding structure, but we view the funding structure as part of the go-forward conversation. Obviously, the governor's budget does not include funding for modernization at this point, but we do have, certainly, we have the data set on what we need to do to move forward and some ideas on how to advance that work under current funding. We will continue to, as I've mentioned, advance modernization. And again, we're going to bring all of our partners to that work, not just the public health departments, but we're excited to see increasing collaborations between public health departments, community mental health authorities, and coordinated care organizations. That's happening across the state and is going to produce results. I'd like next to talk about our Oregon State Hospital. The accomplishments this year, probably the most important one in our current budget situation, is the fact that we have certified units. The state hospital has been working for 2 years to go through the federal certification process so that we can bill and bring federal dollars into the funding for the state hospital to take some of the pressure off the general fund that the state hospital creates. I'm very proud of that work. It was onerous on a detail level and really took a spirit of let's get this done to persevere and make it happen. Superintendent Roberts deserves the credit for leading that effort.
Ms. Sexton,
yes.
I'm sorry, I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
So what does that mean to have certified units that you can bill for federal reimbursement? Maybe I should know after all these years on this committee, but I don't.
It's Superintendent Roberts, as many of you know, came to Oregon from New Jersey and had the experience there of success. We had never billed successfully in Oregon for people who are on Medicare but happen to be in the state hospital. The federal government has very restrictive requirements for state hospitals. They, As we know from our work with the U.S. Department of Justice, they are not fans of state hospitals because they are institutions. That being said, Superintendent Roberts began years ago to say, yes, but there are people who live in the state hospital. It's unfortunate, but they do, and they are entitled under law to pulling down that funding to their care in the state hospital. And so I think about 4 or 5 years ago, he began the work to do this, and you have to meet criteria for those units. The population has to meet criteria, federal criteria, and so we began that process years ago, just completed. It's about $60 million per biennium impact in bringing federal funding into the state hospital.
Cool.
Other accomplishments for the state hospital this year is we expanded collaborative problem solving, which is an evidence-based successful intervention in serving those with acute behavioral health issues. It's an intervention that is used in many locations around the state. My previous employer used it, but it is takes a lot of training, and it changes the dynamic in the milieu to use less restraint and seclusion, less force, less violence. And I've been trained in collaborative problem solving. It really is a, I'm not certified, but it's a different way to work with people who have chronic mental illness. And it's much more holistic, and it has the effect of changing how they think about how they're interacting with other people. So it has very real consequences when people leave institutional settings, good consequences, and go into the community. We're very proud of that work. And as a result, we've reduced seclusion incidents and restraint events. We have a performance excellence breakthrough initiative. We were recommended by the Joint Commission in our last accreditation process that we should be pursuing national excellence awards. We're doing the homework and the requirements to apply for a Malcolm Baldrige Excellence Award. We have improved our electronic health record. It's not all the way there yet, but we've made progress. We have opened the sensory garden, which is one of the things I like the best about Oregon's state hospital, is the amount of time that our residents there can be outside without being directly managed or supervised. They can have independent time outside, and that's really critical to people with behavioral health issues and really is part of the Oregon ethic overall. So we're very proud of that.
Ms. Saxon, any
winners? Since you talked about restraints, have we reduced the number of employee injuries and reduced our... She knew I was going to ask it.
I'm laughing because she and I are channeling the same questions today.
And our workers' compensation cost. In that vein, when you talked about the cultural changes inside of the state hospital, how difficult or is it difficult to recruit employees to work at the state hospital? What is one the turnover rate? You don't have to get it now, but I think this committee needs to know. What is your turnover rate? And are we still seeing an uptick between civil and forensic commitments?
Okay. Let's make sure we get one of those at a time. Let's start with the employee assaults.
Thank you, co-chairs and Senator Winters. Let me go down. I have seven, so let me make sure I cover them. First of all, with regard to employee injuries, I think in the day that the hospital makes its presentation to you all, I meet with our represented workforce on a monthly basis, and they are some of the strongest advocates of collaborative problem solving and the impact it has on reduction of employee injuries. We'll bring you that specific data. In terms of the compensation costs, there are some challenges we face there, and I'd like to bring those forward in a more thorough manner in the state hospital discussion. But I generally think that Superintendent Roberts has done an impressive job of managing the work setting. The do we have a hard time attracting employees? I think we do better at the state hospital attracting employees than most nonprofits I talk to who operate hospital-level facilities because of the difference in our compensation and benefit model from the private sector, private nonprofit sector of service delivery. I think, as you point out accurately, Senator Winters, the larger challenge is the turnover rate. I think we've made progress there, but I'd like to give you the detailed data.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Director Saxton, do you have a sense of your average occupancy in the state hospital?
Mm-hmm. So, oh, and I forgot, so co-chairs, Senator Winters, Senator Buehler. Two things. One is the aid and assist population referrals to the state have increased, have been on a steady increase. They just recently decreased a little bit, but not enough. We have a task force including judges, district attorneys, safety, public safety officials, and others who are working on a plan with Dr. Shahan to further reduce that, and we anticipate bringing law changes to you to help us do that work better. So that's to respond to that. Again, we can bring you the data. The average census at the state hospital is between 575 and 600, not counting Junction City. Junction City today is not fully occupied, and part of the challenge that we are under, and we'll bring you this a very robust discussion on this. The U.S. Department of Justice Performance Plan, which we negotiated a year ago, requires us to get more people out of institutional settings and into community-based settings. So we have done a fairly thorough analysis of what the exact capacity of the state hospital in Salem needs to be, mm-hmm. and part of that discussion is the reflection of the proposed closure of the Junction City facility in 2018, because our assessment, bottom line, mm-hmm. is that the state of Oregon, with the size of our population, should need, if we have a robust community-based setting, about average 575, 600 a day.
And Paula?
Sure.
And how many total beds do you... So your occupancy runs 575 and you have 600 beds mm-hmm. in Salem?
Mm-hmm.
One more question?
Yeah.
So if that's the case in terms of needed capacity, why did we build the hospital in the first place?
Co-chairs, Senator Buehler...
Sorry, we're not allowed to.
I don't know.
Maybe I'm naive since I wasn't here at that time, but it's not higher math.
So, but I do have people who do understand why that decision was made, and they'll be coming and talking in the state hospital component. But I think there was a sense, this is borne out in the documentation and in the U.S. Department of Justice Performance Plan, we don't have a sufficient community infrastructure to keep people out of
right.
the state hospital currently.
That makes no sense.
I would agree, and I just want to use this opportunity to mention that the Behavioral Health Collaborative, which has completed its work, will be bringing forward to you their report and recommendations following our tribal consultations at the end of this month.
Okay. Hang tight for one second. I know Senator Gelser has a question or comment. I think Senator Winters does. My co-chair and I have not discussed this, but it occurs to me that there's something we probably ought to think about. Two things. I personally am going to give committee witnesses the permission to not go through the whole Madam Co-Chair, Senator, whatever. If my colleagues aren't, you can just respond directly to the senator or the representative who asked. It's going to save us time. And if you're in the middle of a return conversation, certainly don't worry about it, because
you.
We don't need to be that formal, I don't think. The second thing is, we have a bunch of members who are really engaged and really smart and really new to this whole topic area. So, colleagues, it may well be that, as you've heard several times from Ms. Saxton already, that there will be questions that come up that we will be covering in a lot more detail. I don't want to shortcut anybody's questions. I also want to make sure that the health authority has the opportunity to get through their whole presentation. So if my co-chair agrees, I know Ms. Ames does a really good job keeping track of questions and making sure that we get everything answered. But if you're confident that something's going to get addressed, in an upcoming presentation, I think we should feel free to say that, give a very brief answer, and know that we're going to get into it in more detail. We will also have phase two, as we'll remind you, to get back into areas that don't get covered adequately in phase one. So I don't want to shortcut questions. I do want to give everybody the opportunity to ask them to make sure they're out there and we know that things are getting covered. But I do also want to make sure we move along. Are you comfortable with that, Co-Chair?
I would agree.
Cool. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. So back to where Representative Buehler was at, the governor's proposed budget does talk about the closure of Junction City. One of the many questions that I get is what the plan is, and I understand that this might not be the right day to have this conversation, but I would like to know what the plan is for the individuals that are there. Mm-hmm. Is there sufficient capacity at Salem to accommodate those that cannot yet be fully accommodated in the community and supported? I agree we don't have a sufficient community-based system, and I hope that that's where we choose to put our resources. And then finally, are there discussions about how to better use the Junction City facility, perhaps to meet some of the needs of psychiatric inmates at the state penitentiary, in terms of continuing to use that facility that's important to Junction City and an important asset in terms of treatment of people that have high needs?
Senator Gelser, we don't know yet that there will be a sufficient community-based capacity to do that closure. And I, having spent 13 years in residential care, absolutely understand that there has to be a connection between the philosophy and the reality for people who require residential care. So I think now, the piece that we'd like to go into and will go into in the hospital presentation is we welcome and want to have all of your input and have a dialogue with you about this very critical social community challenge. And what we need to talk to you about in that context is the performance plan with the U.S. Department of Justice, because part of the reason we have a performance plan, and we're very proud of that plan and negotiated it successfully, and I want to give our team credit for negotiating it successfully to the reality of Oregon as opposed to where the U.S. Department of Justice came into Oregon with their view of what our behavioral health system should look like. But there are very real requirements that we must make in the next 3 years, and we don't have another bite at that apple in their mind, because we have been slow to develop the community-based system we need. I think we can do that now. Obviously, we are working every day with the population that requires hospital-level care and are very cognizant of the fact that we can't just make a theoretical decision that we're not going to have the hospital anymore if we don't have someplace to go. That would produce probably another U.S. Department of Justice agreement. And I would underscore that those agreements and those processes are expensive. They're time-consuming. They involve many, many lawyers, and in my experience, lawyers are not always the best people to design behavioral health systems. So I think Oregon has to roll up their sleeves on this one and get it done.
Thank you. Okay.
You ready to go next? You all know that Superintendent Roberts is retiring. He extended his retirement date graciously to April. We're very thankful to him. The national recruitment for a superintendent has been very challenging, needle in a haystack. When you have the best in the country, it's hard to find the next person who can do that work. We have built a management structure at the state hospital, and I talk to them on a weekly basis for an hour on all performance indicators of the state hospital, all challenges, all employee issues, patient issues. That team is in place, and Greg has agreed to be an advisor to us in his retirement on the schedule that his wife allows him to advise us on the work. But he has done remarkable work, and we are interviewing with legislators, I believe it's tomorrow night, a very attractive candidate that we've spent about 18 months identifying. So we're hopeful but not sure yet that we have found Greg's replacement. Okay. let's talk about the Health Systems Division. The Health Systems Division, as you know, is led by Dr. Shahan and is the execution division for Medicaid services. We want to start with the transformation of Oregon's healthcare system that has helped us bend the cost curve. We often are the study focal point for other states who are facing healthcare challenges, and we like to share this chart because it shows a $1.3 billion savings since 2013, and we're projected to have a total saving of $10.5 billion by 2022. Obviously, there are many caveats in our continued ability to do that, but it's important to know that we're on trend to continue to save the state of Oregon a significant amount of money. Now, part of what, when people talk to us about our healthcare system, part of what they admire are probably four key components. The first is, in 1994, Oregon adopted a prioritized list, and we are the only state in the country that has done that, and we are the envy of many. We have regular conversations with people, and multiple states have tried to adopt a prioritized list and have not been successful. Secondly, we set sustainable capitation rates for CCOs and are actively promoting greater adoption of value-based payment arrangements between CCOs and their network providers. We use a 3.4% average annual growth limitation. That growth limitation, which was built into our first five-year waiver, is also in the new waiver, which you've probably heard about in the newspaper. That limitation, again, one would assume those limitations exist across the country. They haven't. Many states have had growth rates higher than that. Many states in this year where the ACA federal match declines even further have very huge challenges, as do we, of course, in how that gap is going to be filled. But the 3.4% controlled annual average, I want to underscore it's an average, is one of the cornerstones of Oregon's success. Yes?
Co-chair.
I was curious, are there states that have lower than 3.4 growth?
You know, there are, and part of, but they also, and we'd be happy to sit down and share that data with you. Our health policy and analytics team would love to talk about that. We have, each state has different configurations, different plans, and so you need to look at those variables as well. Part of what I think is particularly impressive about Oregon is that we are concurrent with controlling the spend, we're requiring evidence-based measures, and we're measuring outcomes not in a full ROI model, but we are able to actually look at, within that expenditure control, what do we actually produce for the members. So, but yes, there are states with lower and much higher. You know, several states are double our growth rate.
Just to follow along that line, and we understand that we're unique and different. One who's been involved in the transformation for some time, but I think it would be well, and you can provide it later, you know, those states that one are lower and those states that are higher, so that we can look at, irrespective of what comes inside the programmatic package.
Sure. I'm going to jump to better care. That's one of the first things that we are most interested. Statewide, the rate of emergency department use continues to improve. We have 2015 numbers here. I would encourage you to, we release a series of reports. We just released our hospital community benefit report, but those reports are, we're very careful to include in those reports kind of visuals that allow you to process a lot of information quickly. I've already mentioned our CCO quarterly report, our legislative report on the health system transformation. Again, lots of good data there, and would refer you to those. We continue to improve quality and outcomes. Not only do the emergency room visit numbers look good, but fewer hospital readmissions. Particularly important to have more adolescent well care visits, particularly in the Medicaid population. That's a really critical need. More health assessments for children in foster care, and improved member satisfaction.
Ms. Saxon?
Yes.
If the 2014 National Medicaid 90th percentile for emergency departments is 39.4 per 1,000 member months, ED visits, where does 43.1 put us?
Currently. I can get you that ranking. I don't have it here. But thank you. I'll get that.
And don't get me wrong, I'm delighted to see these trends. I mean,
yeah.
These are really good priorities.
This is what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
More people have access to a primary care provider. CCOs across the state are providing integrated physical, oral, and behavioral health care. I want to be really clear here, and I would encourage you again, we have just a stellar data set on CCO performance metrics. The performance across the state is variable. So I'm not telling you that in 3 years we've launched this massive health system reform and all parts of the engine are running smoothly and we can all kick back and work a 50-hour work week. We're in that part where of the evolution of any startup where we have to really lean in and look at what we've learned about what we're doing and begin to adjust, correct, improve. And so we have absolutely some integrated care issues across the state where behavioral is not integrated with physical and oral is not integrated with physical and behavioral. That being said, we have some tremendous examples across the state where CCOs, community partners, school districts, nonprofits have, without our, kind of cracking the whip in any way, they have innovated beyond current performance in other states. And when CMS Administrator Andy Slavitt was here in November, one of the things he said, we took him to some of the focal points of success around the state, and he was amazed at what we had been able to accomplish in integrating care. But the work is not done. The work has begun, but our trend lines are in the appropriate direction.
Representative Buehler.
Director Saxon, I agree with you completely on that, and someone who's intimately involved on the front lines of healthcare transformation. There's been lots of talk about CCO version 2.0. Who's doing that work right now to make the leap from 1.0 to 2.0?
Representative Buehler, co-chairs, many people are doing that work. So let me just give you the top few.
And can you give me a summary of bills that represent the summary of that work in this session?
I can answer that question maybe better than you can. But if you start and then
so
I'll go.
Two things.
Because I've got one of the bills.
As you know, Representative Greenlick has, in the interim, there was some legislation on CCOs 2.0. Mm-hmm. That evolved into the Oregon Health Policy Board taking on a look at CCOs 2.0. They have, if they have not released their report, they met yesterday and they will be releasing their report. The CCOs themselves are working hard to inform that process. The agency has, I think, is very committed to giving anyone interested in what CCOs 2.0 should be access to the data that we have to inform that discussion. One of the things, there are some recurring themes in those discussions depending on which sector of the healthcare system you're involved in. But we encourage everyone to be at that table and part of that discussion, and we have the data set to inform that discussion.
So are there specific bills now that are available that we can?
Yes. So our legislative, Justin is here today, and we can give you a list of the bills that we know are circulating on that topic.
Thank you.
But I would add that most of them are in preliminary form, or at least the biggest ones, because I've been working very closely with Representative Greenlick on this throughout. I was involved with a lot of conversations with Director Saxton and Leslie Clement and Zeke Smith from the Health Policy Board, and we plan to be meeting later this week, I think, to be discussing the report from the Health Policy Board and how we see that evolving. I know other people are working on stuff too, but in terms of the process that Representative Greenlick and I have been working on with the Health Authority and the Health Policy Board, that's where that stands currently. We're happy to engage other members as soon as we've got a chance to digest it ourselves.
Did I add any other questions?
That's fine, thank you.
Okay.
It seems like we have a short timeline for such a complex subject.
I think
matter.
A lot of work has been done on it already, Representative, and it doesn't mean that we don't need to have a robust public conversation, but the reality is that it will end up in front of this committee because it will have a fiscal impact and it will affect the Health Authority just because that's how these kinds of bills work. And so in general, policy bills with fiscal impacts don't come through this, don't really get solid hearings until June. So we've got some time to think about it.
Again, we're happy to answer questions, provide data. Okay, so let's continue with the Health Systems Division, which is accountable for the Oregon Health Plan member experience. They have been heavily engaged this year. As many of you know, this is the year of the one eligibility system where we move from Cover Oregon to one, which, and this is the year of data correction. So I would call your attention to 2015, where we had a conversation about whether we should just roll the data, highly technical term, but roll the data from the Cover Oregon system into the new one eligibility system. We made a conscious decision not to just connect the computers and put the information through, but rather to make sure that we were entering the information correctly. That's a laborious process. It's taken longer than we thought. It's been harder than we thought. And we have we will be through all of those adjustments, corrections, and revisions in March next month. We have, as many of you know, the one eligibility system was a core model selected to stand up because it was did not have all the complexities that we had tried to launch in Cover Oregon. It has build-outs that were anticipated when the system was deployed. We now look at those build-outs and determine what order we do them and what the plan is for executing that process. It's a complex one, but we have been successful after 2 years to recruit and hire a business IT lead who has in-depth experience both with business processes and the execution of those processes through IT. He's just joined our team. We're thrilled. It took him having grandchildren in Oregon to get him here, but whatever it takes. So we are happy to do a detailed discussion with you on this whole process. It is complex and has many components, and we'll be bringing more back to you. But the project has been proceeding. I do want to underscore that the applicant portal, which is one of the original ideas, that people would not have to go somewhere to sign up for Medicaid. As many of you probably have seen, the Bezos Foundation research that says many people who are homeless and have no resources in the 21st century have a smartphone because that's how you get a job and that's how you get access. So our applicant portal opened successfully this year. People can do it electronically, and we are pleased that that launch in the midst of this data correction process was successful.
Question. Senator Winters, and then Representative
and that's... That's a good plus. Thank you on the access portal. Is the one eligibility also including DHS as well?
Yes. In fact, Senator Winters, one of our challenges that Director Psyche and I are currently working on is the transition to the and to the successful implementation of the Integrated Eligibility Project. And we are hard at that, and again, happy to talk about it further, but that is work in progress at present.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you. Just quickly, as we do the transition, and you mentioned Cover Oregon, one question I've asked before is, in your opinion, is there still a state liability back to CMS for any recruitment or clawback on the Cover Oregon funds that were provided by the federal government under the ACA? There's a provision that would allow that, but I don't see anything in the budget for a contingency there.
Representative Hayden, is there an exposure there? I believe there is an exposure there. Have we been asked for that money from CMS to date? No, we have not. Have we received any indication from CMS that they would ask for that money? And various people have various theories on what money would be expected. We've currently offered some of the settlement from the Cover Oregon. There's some software availability, et cetera, in the settlement from the Cover Oregon lawsuit or negotiation. But we have not received to date any indication from CMS that that would occur. I certainly have it on my dashboard as something I still think about, and our finance team is focused on how that would occur and what that would look like. I do want to say that at the beginning of my tenure, my husband's previous law firm represented Oracle, and so the official spokesperson for the health authority on the Cover Oregon and what happened with those assets and where they go going forward is our CFO, based on all the documents I've filed with the Attorney General, et cetera. So I can't go into more detail with you on that, but we do have it on our dashboard of risk.
I know Representative Alonso Leon has a question, but Ms. Ames, do you want to?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify, we've also asked DOJ for their perspective on that question, but I haven't heard back yet.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative?
Yes, I wanted to go back to the self-sufficiency model around the application process for OHP members. Can you remind me, is the information, the application process online in dual languages or various languages to support our different language speakers? And understanding that not all, that we have segments of our community that doesn't use the internet or don't have smartphones, that they're still places where they can go get registered and so forth. Can you just share that a little bit?
So, yes, thank you, Representative. And first, welcome.
Thank you.
It's very nice to meet you.
Likewise.
So a couple things. We have had, since inception of the ACA in Oregon, community assisters across the state. They have done remarkable work in reaching out to communities that don't have language access, but we have several advances we have made since startup to improve access. One is that when the one eligibility system stood up on December 15th of 2015, it did bring 8 languages of availability forms in languages, which made it easier to access. The first time that I accessed one in the trial days, it was in, Chinese to use the tool. So we've made a modest step there, and it has improved access. We fully understand that not everyone has that smartphone, and we also fully understand, I was with Lutheran Family Services in Southeast Portland about 9 months ago with a room full of refugees who spoke probably in that room 9 languages, and so we were talking about the opportunities and the work plan we have to improve language access. So I would tell you that we have made significant progress in the last 3 years. We have a work plan for what is left to do, and we'd be happy to sit down with you and go through. I can't give you the detail today on this when the various languages occur, but there is a work plan for that work, and it is front and center as we plan for the not only the continued improvement of the one eligibility system, but as we get ready for integrated eligibility to ensure that we're making those gains. But I want to give a specific shout out to the community assisters who have had to work with difficult paperwork and difficult software and people in critical need and have done, you know, I would suggest heroic work in helping us and being our partners in implementation.
Thank you. Director Saxon, do you have any sense about how many people have used the online platform to register and go through the process thus
the
far?
Applicant portal?
The applicant portal, sorry.
So are we up over 7,000? I'm not. Do you guys have? I'll get you that number, but it's a slow progression, but it's pretty. It was larger than we expected.
So I would point out to my colleagues that we tend to hear about IT disasters and we don't hear about IT successes. This is an IT success, and I think it's important to point out the hard work that OHA put into this to make it accessible and to provide an opportunity for people to do some really important work in a very wide range of areas, whether that's public libraries or smartphones or other places where the internet is available. And we have not heard boo about problems with its functioning. And sometimes no news is really good news, and I think that's true in this case.
Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward, and Wes and Vivian, if you're listening to this presentation this morning, I just want you to know that goes right at you, so thank you.
I'm sorry, a quick comment, and I'm assuming we're talking about data a lot, and certainly tracking data of who's using, you know, you said you have different languages online. It would be really good for us to know what, you know, languages, what
great
populations are actually using the online system so that we know that it's working.
Representative, we'd be happy. Thank you. That's a critical aspect of this work. And we'd be happy to break that down for you. I also would encourage you, I know during session there's an opportunity because you're in Salem, but I also know you're all extremely busy. But we would welcome the opportunity to show you this work being done live. One of the things that I did several years ago is sit down at a terminal and look at how this is done. Our workforce most of our workforce is in Salem at the call center, and we'd be happy to demonstrate their challenges and their performance. Okay. Member experience, again, is a key indicator on our website. You can look at member experience by CCO, by region of the state. It's a critical performance indicator for us. Thank you. I'd like to discuss the behavioral health system now, and our priorities have been to improve behavioral health outcomes for consumers, to improve equitable access to effective services in every part of the state, and to improve efficiency and cost effectiveness in service. And those all sound like pretty standard goals. I want to kind of peel that back a little bit and share with you how we at the Oregon Health Authority now view behavioral health challenges. Excuse me. We began developing a behavioral health map 2 years ago, and that work progressed and produced a product. We then contracted with the Farley Center from University of Colorado to help us in the Behavioral Health Collaborative, and lo and behold, they had a behavioral health mapping tool that was far more sophisticated than ours and could be used effectively to help us get to the data that we need to be able to improve care. For me, the behavioral health question needs to have all the science and data that we have for physical health. And particularly and specifically, I have asked my team to identify, using these tools we now have, using the report from the Behavioral Health Collaborative, which you will see, what the unmet need is in Oregon, what the current spend is on behavioral health services and the performance of that spend, and to get very concrete about how we are going to bridge the gap of need in behavioral health services that has existed in this state for a very long time. And we are hard at that work. I don't believe that getting people's behavioral health needs met is an abstract conversation with no deadlines and no timelines and no budget. We're going to have all those details because we have a tremendous unmet need in Oregon. When we prepared the statistics, which you'll see in the collaborative report, we have a number of critical behavioral health needs where 30% of the population is getting what they need, 10% of the population is getting what they need, and some of that is about looking at what we're doing and the money we're currently spending and redirecting that effort to what is effective and a proven intervention. So it took 50 people on the Behavioral Health Collaborative 7 months to produce the 4 recommendations or so you're going to see. And, of course, we expect our tribal partners to have additional recommendations or different recommendations for our tribal populations, which are acutely impacted by behavioral health needs in Oregon today. But we're going to quantify this problem and hold ourselves accountable to making progress that is visible and understandable to you and to the people of Oregon in the behavioral health space. We have some challenges. I've mentioned already the 370 referral population to the state hospital. This is one that will require the judiciary, the district attorneys, and the public safety community to help us address. We can't address it by ourselves, but we have their support. We have their interest. Mental health, Multnomah County, one of the largest mental health jurisdictions in the state in terms of volume of need, recently created a mental health court. And we have to get on this. When we have people going to the state hospital for littering in a public place at a cost of per episode of care somewhere around $64,000, we're not making good decisions, we're not using public resources correctly, and most importantly, we're not meeting the needs of that individual who, quite frankly, doesn't need to be in the state hospital even with some of the chronic mental health issues that individual had.
Colleagues, just to be clear, I think most of you may know this, but 370 is the Oregon statute that refers to people who are unable to aid in their own defense, and they're the ones who were sent to the state hospital for evaluation and possibly treatment to get them ready to do that. So you'll hear that term bandied around a lot. You may well have already known that, but I'm a big believer in making sure everybody knows what's going on, what the fancy terms are that are getting thrown around.
Thank you.
My apologies. Our staff said not to use any acronyms, and I didn't think of 370 as an acronym. But you're right. I apologize.
I think I have, as I said, a very well-educated and hardworking committee, but I also know a lot of them are new to this field. So, Representative Buehler.
Yeah. Thank you. Director Saxon, I know you're passionate about this issue from your prior work experience, and I heard you say something very similar 2 years ago. Can you explain to me the barriers to solving this problem, and specifically the barriers to integrating behavior health into the CCO model?
Representative Buehler, first of all, I want to say in the last 2 years we've made progress in overcoming some of those barriers. One of the barriers was the data. So the data was disaggregated between Medicaid behavioral health, non-Medicaid behavioral health, and our own agency had disaggregated behavioral health. So we've made progress in integrating how we as an agency handle behavioral health. Data was one. Second is there is a strong belief in the behavioral health community that the system is funded inappropriately. I have conversations with our partners from time to time about, is the question more money or is the question that the money is currently being spent inefficiently? My expectation is when we complete our analysis, it will be both. Thirdly, the Oregon Health Authority has 2 sets of statutes and accountabilities with regard to behavioral health. We have the Community Mental Health Program Authority, Local Mental Health Authority statute and funding pool, which is funds the county safety net program for behavioral health issues. And I want to underscore that the counties do a remarkable job in that space because they are responsible for the safety net, not just for Medicaid, but for non-Medicaid. The health authority also has a statute and authority for the CCOs and the effective delivery of behavioral health services under Medicaid. 2 years ago, we put those used to be separate teams at the health authority. They did not work closely together, and they did not integrate their effort to a common outcome. So we moved those people into proximity and began looking at data not just through the, well, it's the CCO funding stream, the local mental health authority funding stream, or X. We began to move that using the behavioral health mapping tool to look at a common set of data. So the integration, we've begun it internally, but then, of course, there was also the integration externally. What we've learned in the last 2 years is that a number of communities across the state, the CCOs and the community mental health authorities, began their own collaboration when the ACA was stood up, and they began talking about what is it we need to have happen in this community, how much money do we have to do that, and particularly it's really necessary to have the school districts, the judges, and the nonprofit community at that table to say who's doing what for whom and how do we do it better together. So again, I don't want to. The collaborative will produce its report later this month, and we'll be able to have a full discussion. But integration at the community level has been a barrier. Finally, there's an and the Farley Center from University of Colorado has been helpful to us in this. There's a conversation we need to have with all the stakeholders in behavioral health about what is best practice. I would use as an example Marion County. I want to give a shout out to the Marion County Sheriff, who for 7 months came to the Behavioral Health Collaborative meetings and walked in every day and said, initially said, I'm not sure what I can do to help you here, but I'm happy to be here, as you know, sheriffs are very polite people. But they've leaned into this, and so they send behavioral health to the crime call, to behavioralists to the crime call, to make sure that if someone doesn't need to go to jail, they don't go to jail. If they're having a psychotic break, jail's not going to help them very much. Right. So I think we have identified the barriers. I think we are on track with the work of the collaborative and the 50 people who did that heavy work, and with our partners, the tribes, to bring forward to you some really clear policy choices about how behavioral health can be done in an integrated way, in a cost-effective way, and most importantly, focused on the needs of the individual, the realistic needs of the individual, and how we can serve them as opposed to having them go through a variety of doors to get services.
Yes, I'm Senator Gilster.
Thank you. I had the opportunity to spend a whole day with the Marion County Sheriff's Office going out with their crisis response team, and what I appreciated was that it wasn't just calls to crime, but the day that I was there, we did a check-in on someone that had had issues in the past, sat with him, and watched the qualified mental health professional and the law enforcement officer really talk with this person about the choices they were making, how things were going. We received a call from another individual that was afraid he was going to commit a crime. He needed to go to the store, but he was having trouble, and he knew he needed to ride the bus, and he was afraid if he got on the bus, he would get agitated and that things would escalate. And it was really great to see the trust that they had built with him, they were able to help him walk through his access to his support staff and really help him make sure that he had the groceries that he needed and he was able to get through the day. So it just was a really worthwhile
That's
thing to do.
Awesome. That will, I'm starting to compile a list of potential field trips for the committee, so I'll put that on the list.
I just need
yeah, and then Representative Hayden. So
just to add on, because it's more than just the sheriff. And I appreciate, you know, that it's my county, and they're doing an incredible amount of work because it also includes the district attorney actually has put one staff person on for this issue. The courts are involved. The hospital's involved. And the community, the greater community, is involved. You know, we've taken this on as a community as a major issue. But I just have one question because I'm just very, most of everybody knows me, this is one of my real passions. And have you set some timelines for the other communities and CCOs? You know, when we, you know, did the reform, you know, we did the reform with, you know, just some very basic principles that says we're going to begin treating in the healthcare field the entire body. And when I say the entire body, that meant when we added behavior health, it's no longer we're going to separate the emotion and the brain and everything, that we're going to be able to holistically. So it seems to me that somewhere in this, in our strategies that we need and talking about what is or what isn't, of how we begin to strategically give some timelines. And I suspect you're probably one step ahead of me and that you're already begin doing that.
Senator Winters, so we just convened this week with our health systems team and our health policy team to develop the work plan. Again, we have work to do with the tribes that is very important and reflects their status as sovereign nations. But we have begun to develop the work plan for behavioral health. My ask of them is I would like to see annual progress at responsible rates of improvement once we complete our work. So they're developing that work plan. I would encourage all of you, we are more than happy to sit down with you and go through work plans. I know that may sound tedious and not glamorous, but it is how the implementation or the vision or your policy direction to us gets implemented, and we're happy to sit down and go through that. I also, Senator Winters, just want to give it a shout out to County Commissioner Carlson, who has a lot of experience in this area and just went on, as we try to get the health systems to work together, just went on the State Hospital Advisory Board to help us get that dialogue going. Okay, so more success stories. The Health Policy and Analytics Division is our analytics team. Was stood up at the beginning of the ACA to ensure that we were holding ourselves accountable and our investments accountable to results, and they do a fine job. This is where you'll hear from them directly from Leslie Clement, who leads the team. But basically, Oregon improved its rank this year in insurance coverage. We moved from 21st to 19th, 93% insured. And bless you, and that's a significant improvement. We're taking important steps to continue to ensure equitable access to coverage. We've developed a plan to monitor access for care for American Indians and Alaska Natives that are currently using Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service.
I apologize for interrupting. I let it fall off my radar that Representative Hayden was waiting for it to ask a question.
I'm sorry.
Small step back to
my fault. I apologize.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Small step back to the behavioral health slide. You don't have to go back to that. But as we continue to integrate the behavioral health and the CCO model, I passionately believe this is one of the last frontiers in healthcare transformation that we really need to tackle. I appreciate that there's a lot of effort going into it this time around, and I think as far as return on investment, it's one of our largest opportunities in Oregon to have a return on investment come back to us. However, there's always concerns. One of the concerns that I have that hasn't been mentioned as a potential barrier as we look at the legislative report from the OHA that came to us, we have a continuing slow ratcheting up of our population that is in the fee-for-service population. Mm-hmm. We're slightly above 15%. Mm-hmm. Arguably, that might be better at 8 to 10%. We understand that there's categorically people that are very difficult to take them out of that fee-for-service, and then there's people that choose to be there for a wide variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. We understand that. But what is the plan of the OHA, and is there a cap? I mean, we're up to above 15% now. Do we have a plan to bring that down to that 8 to 10%? And my concern is that this could become a potential barrier if we get the behavioral health in the CCO more integrated, but then we don't have it over here.
Representative Hayden, I appreciate you bringing that forward. That the state of Oregon would be the fourth largest CCO at present. And that's not part of the plan or part of our goal, and doesn't allow us to be as effective as we need to be as an agency. So we have a team in the health systems division working under Dr. Shahan and with Rhonda Busick, who some of you may know. But we are looking at the fee-for-service population and identifying who are the people that we effectively can move off of fee-for-service. I want to underscore that the tribes, by statute, are not required ever to move off of fee-for-service. We're doing some work with the tribes to give them the capacity to do and the funding to do their own care coordination, which would make them eligible for FMAP funding at the fully funded FMAP at the federal level. So we're focused on making that work better for tribal peoples. But we're also looking at the people who are on fee-for-service. The CCOs are very interested in having those people go on to CCOs. A lot of things were carved out of the CCO system when healthcare was stood up, so a lot of mental health services were carved out. We're setting timelines for carving those in. Our goal is to get the fee-for-service population down to only what it needs to be. Our concerns there are twofold. One is access to care. People on fee-for-service tend to have less access to kind of the what it's called specialty care, surgeons, etc. Second, it's quite honestly an outdated healthcare model. It's not integrated care. It's very expensive and takes a lot of time and effort. And then finally, I'm just really concerned about the outcomes, right? Because we don't see the outcomes as clearly as we do with the rest of our health system. So we are every bit as concerned as you are. We welcome any suggestions to help us move people off of fee-for-service as quickly as possible, but we do have a team working on it.
Yeah, thank you. And one of my concerns in that is in our statute we have some of those carve-outs that were originally designed under the idea of the MCO or the medical care organization, the dental care organization, or the behavioral health, yet those statutes have not been updated to reflect the CCO model. And so maybe some of those carve-outs currently in statute are not appropriate to what we're trying to do with the AAA. So,
and I think that ties in well with Representative Buehler's question about CCOs 2.0, Representative, and we would agree with you.
Okay. So, challenge, we need to address it, and again, we'd be happy to go into more detail with you at your
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to... I talked about this a little at my opening. These are the cornerstones of Oregon's success. We have people call us about this on a regular basis from other states who are trying to get their systems into a more rigorous analytical frame or a more controlled financial frame. I want to underscore the metrics that drive the results, and that I really encourage you, if you have only 15 minutes for our website, go in and look at the level of metric data we have. There's been a lot of discussion about, well, you know, we need tougher metrics, and we need more metrics, and we need behavioral health metrics. We look to you for guidance and direction there. I agree with you. We can tighten and improve those metrics. Maybe the bar can be set higher. It should be continuously over time. But the fact that we have the level of information about what is occurring in our health system right now is a tribute to the people who did that design work at startup, and it is a cornerstone.
Ms. Saxton, one thing that at some point in your presentation I would appreciate an update on is the implementation of Senate Bill 440, the unified metrics plan for all carriers in the state, which I believe was finally stood up this January, with the intention of having standardization across all plans, because if metrics are good for one population, they should be good for all populations.
Yes.
So.
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, we'd be happy to provide that. And I think probably one of the strongest voices for that need to simplify that has been our physician population, which has been stalwart and supportive, but also is getting exhausted, and we've got to simplify and streamline that. So we'd be happy to give a detailed report on them.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk this. I want to go back. This diagram, this coordinated care model diagram, which is in all these bright colors, this is really a handy tool for people who are learning what is it about the Oregon healthcare system. This is one that says it as concisely as possible: better health, better care, lower costs. So I just call that out to you as an easy frame of reference. This is the Health System Transformation 2.0. We began discussing this in the last biennium as we were projecting what Oregon needed to do to move forward with healthcare transformation. And, of course, that challenge has taken on a different form with changes at the federal level, which we're monitoring closely. But we have work to do now. This is a startup. We made a lot of progress really fast in some areas. We didn't make progress sufficiently in other areas. And we appreciate your collaboration in helping us get this right going forward. I want to call out the priorities that have been set are to maintain health coverage and to maintain coverage for the people who are eligible for Medicaid, and also the current level of benefits. We have a work plan for ourselves of things to accomplish, the most significant, which began even before the election, was to achieve the waiver and get a waiver for the next 5 years. I want to give recognition to Medicaid Director Lori Koiner and Jeremy Vandehay on the governor's staff. It was Jeremy's idea to bring out Administrator Slavitt prior to the election to look at Oregon's success, to see it firsthand. And as a result of his efforts and Medicaid Director Lori Koiner's efforts, we did secure that waiver for the next 5 years. That's a significant accomplishment. There were a team of 13 people who worked from the 1st of November all through the holiday season, nights, weekends, everything, to ensure that we could meet the deadlines. It took a lot of work with CMS for them to prioritize Oregon and secure that waiver, but that was job one, and that has been accomplished. The chart that you see here is the Medicaid chart for Oregon. This is one of our the charts that people use the most. It's surprising to many people how many counties have up to 39% of the population using Medicaid today. I would remind all of us that somewhere between 35% and 40% of the people on Medicaid are employed. So I'll just give you that chart. We now have to focus on continuing to expand the coordinated care model, continuing to improve the integration of physical, behavioral, and dental care. We're refining, as Senator Steiner-Hayward mentioned, our state's rigorous metrics and to ensure that it is a tool and not a burden. We need to continue to reduce emergency department visits. Many of you may have seen the study we released on hospital boarding, which is part of the current challenge we're having with our behavioral health system, is people using emergency rooms to be boarded as we try to get them to another place in the community for their care. And finally, we have to continue to build on the success of the patient-centered primary care homes. If you have not had the opportunity, some of you have because you've been involved in health policy for some time, but if you've not seen a patient-centered primary care home, please let us know and we will arrange a tour for you. They are remarkable, and they're remarkable from my perspective. Everyone has something different they like about them, but I want to call out three transformational elements of those patient-centered primary care homes. First, when a person goes into those patient-centered primary care homes, they often get access to behavioral health services without any stigma or with have to go in through a door that says mental health or to identify themselves as someone who needs mental health services. And that's remarkable, particularly in rural Oregon. We see people, including military service veterans, who quite simply don't want to walk through a door that says mental health. And so these patient-centered primary care homes have been remarkable for that. Second, they're remarkable in that they are the healthcare professionals who work there. I've toured a number of them, both in the CCO service continuum, but also in the private service continuum. And everyone, I have people rushing up to tell me, healthcare professionals telling me how much they prefer working in that model. We have heard consistently that newly graduating primary care physicians are from medical school are seeking out that model because they find it professionally fulfilling because of the results they're getting for people. Finally, number three that is critical to health system transformation and is part of my own interest is they use process engineering. And I'm a big fan of process engineering and have seen it deployed in a number of sectors to improve productivity and reduce costs. And the patient-centered primary care homes have used process engineering to ensure that they can get to as many people as possible. Not perfect yet, caused a lot of stress and pressure. I'm fully respectful of that. But the model is worth looking at in terms of making our healthcare dollar go further. And again, if you'd like to tour one of those facilities, we'd be happy to take you.
Ms. Saxton, I'm going to take the liberty of having the last word today because I'm going to need to wrap up. I would add a fourth point to that. There was a very robust study that was published by Portland State University this fall that showed dramatic cost savings for investments in patient-centered primary care homes. I mean, in the first 3 years under the collaborative primary care initiative, comprehensive primary care initiative, the estimate was we saved $246 million, and
yes,
the ROI was something on the order of 1 to 15, or 15 to 1 more accurately. And it only got better as time went along. The longer people were seen in a specific patient-centered primary care home, the higher the savings amount went. And if you have not seen that study, we'd be happy to provide it to you because it's really dramatic.
Okay.
Well, we're going to take a break there, and we'll look forward to seeing you back tomorrow.
Can we start on this slide?
Yes, we can start on this slide tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay, we're adjourned. Yes, we can start on this slide tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay, we're adjourned.